This is an ABC podcast.
Aloha kākou and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We acknowledge that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Thank you for tuning in. What's on the show this morning? Well, there's heavy rain in Fiji. It's been causing flooding and closures of schools. And there's no bank in Nauru. We'll get the latest on that. And science is now backing Pacific traditional knowledge. More on those stories shortly. Once we're done, find our stories at abc.net.au/Pacific or via our Facebook and Instagram pages. I'm Aggie Tupou, your host, and you're tuning into Pacific Beat. To Fiji, where a heavy rain warning is still in place after the country experienced a weekend of flooding, causing school closures, power outages, and hundreds having to find refuge in evacuation centres. So for more on this, I'm joined now by Arun Chandra, the town administrator of Ba, one of the hardest hit areas in Fiji. With that, I say Bula Arun and welcome to the program.
Bula, how are you?
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Gosh, how bad has the storm been for your community though?
It has been very bad. Actually, the rivers, they start up from the mountains. It's about 30 to 40 kilometers away from low-lying areas and from urban areas. By the time the water reaches the low-lying areas, urban areas, there's a big flood there. There are a lot of small rivers that join the bigger rivers. That's why the flooding is very big. The government is not in a position. This is a poor government. They are not able to do 4 or 5 bigger rivers that hold the country, like the one in Lambasa, Sigatoka, Nandi, Ba, and Tabua. It's going to cost a lot of money to do the dredging. And that's why the floodings are very wide. There are a lot of people who suffer from these floodings. There are business houses, there are laborers, there are school children, there are cane farmers, vegetable farmers, who suffer a lot from these floodings and heavy rain.
Arun, have you been able to speak to some of the residents there in your community? What have they been saying?
They have been saying that this thing has been happening for a long time. Nothing has happened to rectify these problems. Actually, we are used to these flooding. We have to go to the evacuation centres, which is far from us. We stay in the evacuation centres for a day or 2 or 3 days without food or without water. We have to suffer a lot for these, our small babies, our small children. They suffer a lot because they are without food, they are without milk, and we actually suffer a lot during these flooding times or heavy rain times because we have to leave our homes to go to higher places because our homes are flooded. Most of our Fijian villages are along the coastline, along the rivers, bigger rivers. Their houses are along the bigger rivers, so they have to wait. Whether it's in nighttime or daytime, they have to leave the home and go to a higher place for better shelter.
Arun, has there been any immediate relief, though, that has been able to come through to your community to help out in any way?
The government is doing their own assessment about the damage and everything. Actually, it's everybody who suffered from this flooding, whether the people living in the high areas or in the lower areas, everybody is suffering. Their crops are damaged, their houses are damaged. The business house, they suffer a lot. The laborers, they don't get wait for 2-3 days until the soap is clean, the streets are open for the people who do the shopping. They are not able to go to the town to do the shopping. They suffer a lot.
And any idea, though, Arun, I know it may be early, but any idea of what the cost of the damages would be to your community?
It might hit into millions of dollars. Actually, our climate change, we are not being educated in climate change. Though our ministers, our people have gone for very big seminars, meetings about climate change to overseas, but when they are back, they haven't told us, the poor people, how to experience the climate change. The climate change has come. We have experiencing flooding every month, or cyclones coming up, things like that. So it's better to somebody to come and talk to us about climate change and how to deal with this changing weather pattern.
Yeah, I want to get into that more, Arun, because as you said, your town has been flooding, or it is like a consistent pattern there in Bar, right? So, and the government is doing their own assessment. But what would you really like to see the government do to address this situation?
We got two major rivers in Bar. They need to be dredged. They need to be done as soon as possible. The previous government, they wanted to do it, but they stopped for some other reasons. Now, this government needs some financial support from overseas or from somewhere where they can do the dredging. If the dredging is done, then actually the water will not be able to enter the town area. So we need the dredging to be done as soon as possible, and some more drains to be built up, some more culverts to be put up so that people have got access to the town.
Arun, are you aware of anyone? I know the houses have been damaged due to the flooding, but are you aware if anyone's been injured or has at least maybe passed away? I hope not.
Nothing so far. Nothing we have received so far. No, nobody has spoken out about the help. But actually, to tell you the fact, people are suffering on the ground. If people come out of the, go to the remote area to find out the villagers and the Indian farmers who are staying up near the rivers, if you go to them, they'll be able to tell you the fact, what's going on with them. And this is not the first time it's happening. It's happening every year. And it's the way the weather is, we might suffer, might be a few more floods going to come in, and we might suffer a lot. School children are stopped from going to school. They are suffering a lot. They are missing the classes. They're going to lose a lot of classes in the time to come.
And as we talk about the weather, though, what is it looking like right now for you
well,
there in
Pa? Well, today is cloudy. There was a little bit of drizzle in the morning. And from tomorrow, Wednesday, they say that the weather pattern is going to change. There is more rain. There might be more flooding. The weather at the moment is in the northern side, Lambasa side. It might move to western side of the BT Lebu. So we might expect more flooding to come in the weekend.
Well, Arun, we really appreciate your time this morning. We know that, yes, damage and things have happened there to your community. We wish you well, and we do hope that those who are in power come through and assist your community there. But we thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, madam. Thanks a lot.
No worries. That, of course, is Arun Chandra, Town Administrator of Bar. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Tubol. Well, history tells us that reading the waves, understanding the stars in the sky, and seeing how birds migrate have long been the way Pacific people navigated the seas and how they adapted to their ever-changing environment. But why has that traditional knowledge not often been received well within the Western worldview? Well, new research has proven that science is now backing that very knowledge to help sustain Pacific Island communities for the future. I spoke with Professor Patrick Australia Centre for Pacific Islands Research at the University of the Sunshine Coast on the significance of traditional knowledge and its effect on climate change.
I lived in the Pacific Islands for over 20 years, so and I heard a lot about that kind of thing, but that was really in my face, you know, sort of 12 different types of waves, you know, each with their own name, 10 different types of wind, each with their own name. These things really sort of struck home to me.
You even say that traditional knowledge, it's now been backed by science. So how significant is it of that role in being able to sustain our Pacific communities for the future?
I don't think Pacific Island people need to be convinced that the traditional knowledge they have, particularly about weather prediction and particularly about climate variability, I don't think they need to be told that that's valid, because it has sustained them for hundreds, often thousands of years on islands in the middle of the ocean. I think the people who need convincing are the people with Western scientific training, who tend to privilege their own view of the world and the explanatory models that they've been taught, as you understand. And they instinctively, I think, push back against or reject traditional knowledge unless it can be validated. I do recognize that having the same story told by Pacific traditional knowledge and by Western science actually does help, because, you know, then People can say, well, there's no doubt about this. You know, in Tonga, they often say that when the moon has a halo around it, that's a sign that stormy weather is coming. Even though it's a calm night, you see the moon with a halo around it. And that's absolutely right, because that halo is formed by ice crystals. And the ice crystals are really a sign that there's a lot of moisture in the upper atmosphere that's becoming very cold, and unstable weather is likely to follow. So that is traditional knowledge that has existed, I would expect, for, you know, a couple of thousand years in a place like Tonga. And Western science is now saying, well, yeah, actually, that explanation, that reading, if you like, of the moon with a halo is absolutely correct.
Why do you think, though, that the usage of our traditional knowledge hasn't really been taken so seriously when we know that's really how our people navigated the seas?
I think the problem comes down to Western science, in a way, which, although we don't know it, is actually a very aggressive type of knowing. It doesn't really allow for anything else to get in its way. It claims to have all the answers. And I've seen this, you know, dozens and dozens of times during the course of my career, that people have traditional knowledge, but scientists will often pretend to listen very, very politely to it, but will completely ignore it. Even though, like you just said, it is clearly valid in the sense that it did sustain your ancestors to travel thousands of kilometers across the Pacific before people in Europe even knew the Pacific existed. And I think that's a really important point. And I use this a lot with my students. I say, you know, the ancestors of today's Pacific Island people, you know, wherever they are, whoever they are, crossed the entire Pacific from west to east, at least probably 200 or 300 years before Europeans so-called discovered the Pacific. They reached Central America in Panama. They reached the coast of California, and they reached the coast of Chile in South America, where there are thousands and thousands of bones of so-called Polynesian chickens that could only have been brought there by long-distance voyages from the Pacific Islands. So the scientific evidence for the effectiveness of those kinds of traditional methods is very, very clear. But that doesn't mean that Western science is particularly tolerant, I think, of other knowledges of that kind.
Even with Western solutions, though, can you maybe just share some of those examples? Like, are you saying, though, that those solutions won't help in any way?
Oh, no, of course not. And I think that's the thing. I think it's time at the moment for sort of for everyone involved to sort of, you know, back off a little bit. I meet people in the Pacific Islands who have no time at all for Western science, who see the world through a completely different lens. And that's fine. That's their right. Okay. But traditional knowledge, particularly about climate variability and climate change in the Pacific Islands, never had to cope with the kinds of things that we are being confronted with at the moment. And this is where science comes in. Particularly, I think science is very helpful in the Pacific Islands in giving us plausible futures. So it's being able to say, okay, in 50 years' time, the level of the ocean surface around your island here is going to be this high. What are you going to do about it? How can you respond in anticipation of this happening? And that's where traditional knowledge comes in. Before you people came to the Pacific, you talk about Europeans, you know, before you people came to the Pacific, we all lived up there in the hills because we knew that the coasts were dangerous places, that they were exposed to changes in the ocean surface and strong waves and winds. But then you people came along and you colonized us and you made us all move down to the coasts. And now you're telling us, oh, we've just learnt that the coast is a dangerous place. It's time for you to move back up into the hills. And he said, you know, our traditions told us that all along. And I think that's one thing, Aggie, that, you know, particularly irritates me sometimes, is that Western scientists or Western trained scientists, even the ones with the best of intentions, sometimes come into the Pacific Islands and say, well, you know, you people know nothing, okay? We are going to tell you what to do because we know what's going to happen. And very rarely do they try to sort of get beneath the surface and find out actually what Pacific Island people do know and what they understand, because it's so much effort.
Knowing that we have our traditional knowledge, but have the Pacific become maybe too reliant on, like, you know, financial assistance from foreign overseas or well-developing countries, what is it that in the Pacific that we can utilize that we already have that could possibly make the change?
I suppose a bed of Pacific Island traditional knowledge that's still known in most island countries that could form the basis for effective adaptation to future climate change. No question about that. You hit the nail on the head. All Pacific Island countries have become increasingly dependent on external funding, particularly to assist with climate change adaptation. I think, and I say this a lot, it's not terribly popular, but I say this a lot, you know, in the Pacific and elsewhere, that richer countries should be doing is not increasing dependency, but increasing autonomy. So actually giving Pacific Island countries the information and the tools they need to cope by themselves. What's going to happen in about 5 or 10 years' time is that the cost of domestic adaptation to climate change in countries like Australia and New Zealand is going to rise so much that those countries, for example, are not going to be able to be as generous to their Pacific Island neighbors as they are at the moment. So Pacific Island countries are going to be forced in the next 10 years or so to stand on their own two feet and to cope with climate change by themselves.
I consider the Pacific people probably one of the most resilient people on Earth, right? Because either by default or by design, we're dealing with those natural disasters, damages to food crops, right? And I know this has been in your piece that you've written about the destruction of infrastructure and even just, gosh, loss of life. So adapting to one's environment has probably become the norm for the Pacific. Do you feel like that is a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. I get hugely irritated these days, you know, when I go and listen to conference papers or presentations and people say, oh, we need to build resilience amongst Pacific Island people because they're so vulnerable, they're so helpless. And I say, it's absolute nonsense, you know. They are, like you say, some of the most resilient people on Earth. And I don't romanticize the Pacific. I mean, there are many other places on Earth that are like that, where people have lived for a long period of time and have built incredible resilience to the kinds of things that you describe. But because outsiders come in and they see those societies and those environments through different eyes, then they think, oh no, these people are incredibly vulnerable, because they don't really invest the time to try and understand whether that really is the case or not.
And that's Professor Patrick Nunn for the Australian Centre for Pacific Islands Research at University of the Sunshine Coast. Up next is News Wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith.
Hi, I'm Seyuli Salamasino von Reiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It is that time. We head around the region to get your latest headlines with your news wrap from producer Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. I know we've been speaking about this issue in Samoa. Of course, there seems to be more disquiet in Samoa over the electoral changes allowing overseas voting. What's happened?
Yeah, no, this is just another development on this ongoing issue. Samoa's parliament passed an amendment earlier this month allowing overseas voters to have their say in the polls for the first time, although to qualify, you must be a citizen and be 21 years or older who have resided in Samoa at some point. And the law also stipulates that applicants must undertake a biometric test in Samoa. Now, the Secretary of the Opposition Human Rights Protection Party, Rimoni Aiafi, told RNZ that these laws were only intended to allow people who had property in Samoa to vote. He says his party is trying to discourage anyone who hasn't lived in Samoa for the past 20 years from voting. He says it's not fair that someone without knowledge of Samoan politics could cast a vote. And Aiafi says another unresolved issue is that any overseas eligible voter could potentially be now exposed to Samoa's compulsory voting laws, which carry fines for non-voters.
Definitely needs to be a lot more clarity around this, isn't there? To New Zealand's foreign minister, though, Winston Peters has met with a Chinese counterpart. He's raised concerns over security deals in the Pacific. What has Peters said?
Yeah, so Wang Yi met with Winston Peters on Monday in New Zealand on the first leg of Wang Yi's Trans-Tasman trip. According to the Australian Associated Press, Peters said that New Zealand is following developments in the Pacific closely, and he wanted to emphasise the importance of engaging through existing regional institutions and arrangements, in particular on regional security matters. That's a quote from Peters. So Australia and New Zealand obviously have long-standing investment in the regional bloc, the Pacific Islands Forum, and Peters comments come after China had secured its own security pact with Solomon Islands in 2022, that taking place outside of the forum.
Mackenzie, thank you so much for bringing our news wrap for this morning.
Thanks so much.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Absolutely tune into that new show, Sister Sound, with Sose Fo'amoli. We head to here and, of course, in Australia, Aboriginal woman Teresa Ellis. She went to a Catholic boarding school and actually forgot her Arunda language. Now that she's learnt how to walk in two worlds, here's a story by Meredith Lake with more.
Alice Springs, in Bantwa, on Arunda Country.
Harinichina, Teresa Ellis.
I went to see poet and Arunda elder Teresa Ellis for morning tea. We were sitting cross-legged at the Indigenous publishing collective that she writes for. Teresa's writing is translated from Arunda to English, which is something she had to learn very young, when she was sent away from home to sit in a classroom that looked nothing like her outback home.
I went away to a boarding school in Ballarat, Victoria, Catholic education.
In learning how to navigate her new white world, something essential to her was fading.
It really changed me in a way I could only see the white world. Not even thinking about myself, who I was. And it's sort of the Western way of education was whitewashing me. They sent us back to home, you know, for the holidays. Came back to mum and dad and brothers and sisters. I forgot about Arunda. I could only speak English, couldn't understand Arunda what mum was talking about. And I could, one day then mum said, there's a ceremony going on, you know. And all the young girls, we all lined up and wanted to be painted and excited and all that, wanted to dance. And all these old ladies were sitting there and they told me, you got to go into that circle and dance. But we was like on the sideline. I kept seeing mum, looking back and seeing mum, dance, dance, saying, dance, dance, you got to dance. I couldn't even move. I couldn't understand the language or the men or the ladies singing, you know. I couldn't, because I was someone else then. Yeah, I wasn't who I was there. When I turned back, I could see Mum. Her head was down. My mum said, turn around and dance. And I couldn't keep saying, I couldn't, I can't, Mum, I don't know. And she started throwing pebbles at my foot so I can move my foot. And she started throwing, all the old ladies giggling and her cousins, they started throwing little pebbles at my foot so I can move my foot instead of stand there. And anyway, I started moving my foot and I could see these girls and nobody was looking at them and they were just dancing. Then I got into the crowd and started dancing and just copying them, what they were doing. And I could turn around and I could see Mum with a big smile on her face. After that, I realized that it was the act of dancing that made you a woman, made you a mother, made you a grandmother. And the act of dancing was who you are, how you was connected to families. And because of those songs and dancing, they knew that I was going to be a mother and a grandmother. And if you're a woman, you got to dance for your sons, for your brothers, for your grandkids, grandsons, you know. So I end up having a son, and I knew that the dancing made me a proud woman to dance. So I danced for my son. And it's the act of dancing that made you who you are and have that knowledge of dancing and singing and be part of that group and part of that ceremonies, you know, that connects you back to who you are. Mm.
Teresa Ellis ending that report there with Meredith Lake.
Pacific Beat.
Now, a study has found Indigenous fire management in Northern Australia began at least 11,000 years ago, and possibly as long as 40,000 years ago. Researchers say the findings highlight the twin importance of climate and humans in fire regimes and could have implications for modern fire management practices. Corey Bradshaw is a professor of global ecology at Flinders University and is among the study's authors. He explains to Thomas Ariti how they figured it out.
Well, it's quite a feat to be able to change basically the entire dynamics of a fire regime on a continent the size of Australia. So while we know, and this is mainly from in the last sort of few hundred years, looking back, we know that we've changed the fire regime to the point where, you know, now the bigger fires are dominating. And then that wasn't the case when Indigenous people were managing the dominant areas of fire, which is basically in the north of the country mainly. But we didn't really have any idea how long ago this might have been. Now, people have been around in Australia for at least 65,000 years. So, were the densities of people high enough to be able to change, you know, entire continents' fire dynamics as early as that, or did it take a long, long time to establish? And it was never really known. We know that it sort of happened at least a couple thousand years ago, and that's kind of the longest available evidence anywhere in the world with Indigenous fire management changing the entire fire regime. Mm. But in Australia, it turns out that it was actually much, much older.
Yeah, much older, it seems. So how did you go about working out when roughly it began? What did you do?
Well, it requires a lot of geochemistry. So we took these soil cores from the bottom of a lagoon quite near Darwin, a place called Girraween, which is actually where Crocodile Dundee, the crocodile attack scene, was filmed.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people might be aware of that. And you take great bloody long cores of the soil underneath the water, and it can go back, the record goes back about 150,000 years, because we can date all the different samples in there. And then we look at the fine geochemistry of the charcoal and different accumulation rates of different types of carbon, and we can tell the intensity of the fires and when it changed. And we looked at the entire record going back 150,000 years, so well before humans arrived, right through their main arrival period and settlement, and then up to pretty much 3,000 years ago. And we found that at least 11,000 years ago, that's when things sort of massively switched. The unfortunate thing is that there's a whole 30,000-year gap in there where we can't really tell what was going on because there was just too little of the chemical elements we were trying to find, and that's just basically because of, you know, the amount of water that was around at the time. But it could have established, up to 40,000 years ago, but definitively by 11,000. So there's a big gap of uncertainty there too.
And why, and don't get me wrong, we know why Indigenous fire management matters, but why was it important to get an idea of just how long Indigenous fire management practices have been used?
Well, when Indigenous people tell you that they've been on country for a long time and doing, you know, management, they're not lying. They've been doing it longer than, you know, the pyramids of Egypt have been around. I mean, this just establishes that massive ability to take control of one's environment and to make it less intense and less dangerous, as well as provide, you know, better food sources for hunting and better visibility and better movement. So It's a massive tip of the hat, really, to how people were able to make their lives better and, in fact, enhance the environment over such huge time frames. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, no, look, no question. Did those practices evolve over time? Do we know whether the things changed, or was it really just so ingrained in that tradition and nothing really had to change?
Well, it could have established over, you know, tens of thousands of years while people developed that relationship with the landscape after their, you know, primary arrival and settlement, getting used to the landscape. But it would have happened so long ago that our records now show that it was firmly established well before the end of the onset of the Holocene, which is the modern warming period about 11,000 years ago.
And important to note before I let you go, you know, tell us the implications this research could have for modern fire management practices. You know, a lot of people are now turning to Indigenous fire regimes to help their fire management these days.
Yeah, well, it's a no-brainer, really. You know, if you go back to the 2019-2020 fires, I mean, those were some of the largest and most intense fires. Now, they were mostly in the south. And as I said, most of our fires actually happened in the north. But we can take a lot of that knowledge and apply it to the sort of small-scale burning that decreases those intense fires and the magnitude of those fires. And we should really adopt a lot of those practices, especially in the south where the people live.
And that is Professor of Global Ecology at Flinders University, Corey Bradshaw, speaking to Thomas Oriti.
Tune in to SBS Samoa News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoa News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoa News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in the Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. According to a new report by the Environmental Defenders Office, climate change and extreme weather events might be putting the health of athletes and spectators at risk, and that in turn could result in legal liabilities for sporting organisations across the country. The report was commissioned by not-for-profit group Frontrunners, and their CEO Emma Pocock talked to ABC's Jess McGuire about the ways climate change is already impacting sport in Australia.
I mean, I think when you take a second to step back and have a think about it, we all know this, we've all seen it, whether it's the professional end of the game, you know, across that Black Summer bushfires we saw, the cancellation of some fixtures, the postponement of some fixtures because bushfire smoke. We've seen players retiring from play at the Australian Open due to extreme heat. Back as far as 2011, we saw Lang Park or Suncorp Stadium, as I think it was known then, being inundated with water and huge damage to the facilities. But we've also seen it locally. You know, most people have had their cricket training or games cancelled because of extreme weather, making it unsafe, or, you know, their kids' Auskick or Little Athletics or Nippers. I think, you know, this is something that we've all experienced, and now we're kind of starting to make those connections that actually climate change is making those extreme weather events more intense and more frequent, and that's having really serious impacts for sport from the professional right through to the grassroots.
So this report is looking at some of the legal liabilities that sporting bodies are quite likely to be facing in the near future. What are some of those liabilities?
Yeah, well, that most obvious one, I guess, is player and spectator welfare. So those sorts of things that we've just discussed. How do you keep players, spectators, officials safe during training and playing? Then it gets into some other ones like infrastructure risks, so that kind of inundation of Lang Park that I just mentioned. But also we see that a lot at the grassroots level. I mean, southeast Queensland, that got smashed by fires and then by a couple of years of flooding. Sporting facilities there have been absolutely decimated by those back-to-back events. And then it gets into the more kind of legalese, you know, the contract risk. So are your broadcast deals appropriately, do they have appropriate clauses in them to manage for extreme weather? Do you have appropriate insurance? Are your insurance premiums going through the roof because you're in a flood or fire prone area? Mm-hmm. And then looking at things like director's duties and reputational risks. So it's kind of the full suite of legal risks, unfortunately.
Is it just big sporting bodies who are going to be legally liable, or are there kind of other cogs in the wheel who might face legal consequences?
Yeah, this is one of the things that the report looks at. So it looks at, you know, the major sporting bodies that we think of, you know, the big governing bodies like the AFL and Cricket Australia and the NRL, but then also at the clubs, at the venue operators, at event organisers, at government bodies that are responsible for some of the sports that we play, like the Australian Sports Commission, and right down to those like state and territory bodies. So there are a lot of people who kind of get swept up in this report. And I think it is pretty scary. But the good thing is that there are some really practical things that sporting organisations can do to try and insulate themselves from some of this risk.
Right. So, I mean, are these things that we've seen done in other countries that we can adopt to address climate change in sports?
Yeah, there has been a bit more movement in other countries. We're not, you know, we're not a laggard by a long stretch, but we are a bit behind. The report found that, you know, only 3 out of the 314 organisations that we surveyed mentioned climate change in their annual report, which means that probably only 3 of those 314 are really thinking about the impacts that it's going to have on their business. But there's some really practical things that you can do, and a lot of them actually don't cost much. It's things like making sure your board's considered climate and put it on the risk register, to other things like making sure you've got heat and extreme weather policies and that all the people who would be responsible for implementing them actually know about them. Because what we found is that there are some organisations who have these policies, but the person at the end of the day who's going to have to make the call isn't actually trained in how to apply the policy. So those sorts of things that are actually quite kind of like administrative ways of responding to these risks.
I want to circle back to the fact that so few sporting organisations actually talk about climate change in any of their annual reports or anywhere that you can really see. I mean, why do you think it is that they're not really showing any leadership when it comes to climate change? Like, I'm wondering, is it to do with like the culture wars and then they're kind of trying to stay out of seeming political, or is it kind of a little bit more capitalistic as far as the sponsorship of certain sports coming from fossil fuel organisations?
I mean, I think it's partly both of those things, but I actually think that the major reason is that sport over the last decade, I guess, has felt like it's tackling a lot of different issues. You know, we've seen sport really take on anti-racism work. We've seen them looking at diversity and inclusion. And I think for a long time they've thought of climate as another social issue that they don't really have the bandwidth to deal with. And what this report makes really plain is that this isn't just a social issue. This is a major risk to your business if you're in the business of sport. And it's time to really make sure you take it seriously, because it's creating a whole lot of legal liabilities that are making your business really vulnerable. So I think the report really does the work of shifting that from a social issue to a business risk. And hopefully that means we'll start to see some changes. I mean, even since we finalised the report at the end of last year, it's thankfully already out of date. You know, we saw last week the AFL released their 2023 annual report, in which they indicated that they're busy putting together their first ever sustainability and emissions reduction strategy. So our hope is that this is out of date as quickly as possible, and that seems to be happening.
What advice would you give to fans of sport who want to see and support climate action within the sporting world?
Yeah, I think that's a really big one. You know, if you are someone who loves a particular sport, loves a particular club, really encourage you to write to them and say that, you know, you've heard about this report or you care about climate and you'd love to see them taking action. Because one of the other big fears, I think, for sport is that they're not quite sure how their fans feel about it. So the more we can let them know, hey, actually, we're going to support you when you start taking action on these things, the more they're going to be able to feel comfortable to do the work to keep everyone safe.
And that is Emma Pocock, the CEO of not-for-profit organisation Frontrunners. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. It's time to take a look back at some of our main stories today. In the town of Barn, Fiji, which is the hardest hit by heavy rain on Monday, Administrator Arun Chandra says the government isn't doing enough to protect his community.
We have to go to evacuation centres, which is far from us. We stay in the evacuation centres for a day or two or 3 days without food or without water. We have to suffer a lot for these, our small babies, our small children. They suffer a lot because they are without food.
And new research finds that traditional Pacific knowledge systems could play a critical role in the fight against climate change if they are taken seriously, as science is.
The scientific evidence for the effectiveness of those kinds of traditional methods is very, very clear. But that doesn't mean that Western science is particularly tolerant, I think, of other knowledges of that kind.
All those stories found at abc.net.au. Appreciate your time this morning. We are back again 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. We are Pacific Beat.